Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. I'm pleased to announce a new series. This is the first episode of our series, Unexpected Encounters, the Jewish Holidays and the Other. The series is presented by Rabbi Daniel Andes, and the series is sponsored by the Alexander Soros Foundation. There are 5 episodes planned, this one on Pesach, and then coming up Yom HaTzmaut, Shavuot, Tisha B'Av, and the Days of Awe. There is a handout for this podcast. I'm sending it as the next podcast episode, so be sure to print it out and use it to follow along with Rabbi Landes. Rabbi Landes is the director of the Pardes Institute. And now, Rabbi Daniel Landes.
Thank you, Larry. I wish to thank the Alexander Soros Foundation for sponsoring a series of podcasts that I will be giving. More importantly, giving me the time to reflect on an issue that I've always concerned me but did not have the opportunity to focus on. And that is I term this series Holidays as Meeting or Holidays as Moed. Each holiday is called a Moed. It's unexpected meetings. It's the rub-up of the Jewish holidays against each other, but internally against something else. So let's refer to this as holidays as unexpected meetings. And we'll start today with the Passover process. If you look at your source sheet number 1, you'll see something that's probably familiar to all of you. The order of the Passover Seder, the Siman L'Seder Shel Pesach. This is the order, and Seder means order. The Siman is the different symbols or symbolic expressions. And let's remind ourselves of what's here. In fact, as you look at it, you know something which is missing, which are the 4 cups of wine. But the 4 cups of wine are embedded within the order of the Passover Seder. Therefore, the very first one, which is Kadesh, reciting the Kiddush, the sanctification, which is a normal thing on holidays, that's the first cup of wine. We go from there to Urchatz, and it's important for me to go through this entire order in the normal expression, the classic order of the Passover Seder, because I soon would like to go into something which is a little different. Urchatz, washing the hands, that's washing the hands without the blessing. This is washing the hands, which many see as what free people within the Greco-Roman world, the classical world, did when they went for their evenings of food and discussion, the symposia. And therefore, washing the hands makes one feel free and is a symbol of freedom. But also from a Jewish point of view, the washing the hands is an elevated moment. Soon we'll be eating a vegetable and water, and it's a complicated discussion, but to make it short and simple, a vegetable and water in the time of the temple was considered something that may very well conduct impurity. You wash your hands to keep your hands from being impure, and therefore for the vegetable not to be impure. And at this night, holiday night, which we're on a higher spiritual level, we wash our hands without a blessing. 3 is the karpas. It's eating a green vegetable. No, not a pickle. A karpas is recognition of Jewish soul food. It makes you hungry. We'll discuss that further, but it's the hors d'oeuvre. From there, we go to the 3 matzot that are on the Seder plate. The Seder plate is the focus of the props for the Seder. And we take from the 3 matzah, we take the middle matzah, we break it, leaving half for the afikoman, and even hiding half for the afikoman, leaving half there. And yachatz is also symbolic of the fact that slaves never have a whole piece of matzah. If that's the case, why don't we break all 3? We keep 2 that are whole, so that we have as traditional, just as we have whole challahs for a regular Shabbat meal or for a regular other holiday. We keep that. But it should be known that the great Gaon of Vilna, Vilnius, in the 1800s, in the 1700s, he was very careful to only have two matzot and to break one of them. And they all said, "Rabbi, how's it possible? You're not having two full." He says, "We are slaves, and a slave never has two full loaves of bread." Same here for the matzah. With the matzah, then, after that, we go to the Magid, reciting the Passover story. That's the long part of the Seder, and it's the with the questions and the answers. And that's also done over a cup of wine. A good hint to you, don't put out bubbly wine for your second cup, because the bubbles will evaporate during the long recitation of the Passover story, the narrative. Number six then becomes Rachsa. If you've done the Passover story, the narrative, you wash your hands. This is washing with a blessing, with the cup. The other one was with a cup also. It's symbolic kind of washing because your hands are already supposed to be clean. And we go there to Motzi Matzah. And Motzi Matzah are two blessings. The normal Hamotzi is brought bread from the earth, and the special blessing that says to us we are commanded to eat of the matzah. And from there we go to the Moror, the bitter herb. It's like a continuation from the blessing of eating the green vegetable in number three. We eat the bitter herb, reminds us of our slavery. Number nine is putting together the Moror and the matzah, the bitter herb and the matzah together in this sandwich that Hillel the Elder, the great moralist, put together at the time of the temple. And number 10 is the meal, Shulchan Orech. We have a prepared meal, we have a wonderful meal, and it's supposed to be very festive and enjoyable. And if you are lucky, someone will have prepared gefilte fish or matzo balls. And, or if you are Sephardic, perhaps even hummus, fresh hummus, which the Ashkenazim do not eat on Pesach. And after that, we go to Tzafun, and we take that hidden piece of the matzah, which was put away for the Afikoman. We take that out, and the last food that we eat that evening is the Afikoman. We go to number 12, which is Barech. We say the grace after the meal. That's the third cup of wine. The grace is said over a cup of wine. We go to Hallel, which is praise of God. And that praise of God, which comes from those great psalms of David and are sung in the most beautiful way possible, very meaningful and very inspiring and fun, that's our fourth cup of wine. We hold that cup or we touch that cup as we sing this praise. It's a cup of jubilation. And 14 is Nirtzah, is the conclusion of the Seder in which we thank God for the Seder. Now, normally these simanim and these order of the Seder is sung at the very, very beginning before the Kadesh. There are many traditional tunes. Kadesh Urchatz, Karpas Yachatz. And I'd continue if I had a better voice, and there's more outrageous tunes. And we have a custom which I think is terrific, which is to sing this in between each of the stages, each of the parts of the order of the Passover Seder. And therefore, at Kadesh, to sing it through completely beforehand, but then to sing it each time, a second time between each sections, and the second time you stop at the place where you're about to do that section of the Seder. Therefore, you would, let's say for number five, the Magid, recitation of the Passover story, before Magid, you would sing it through the whole thing, 1 through 14, all the way through. And then the second time, only 1 through 5, it's always hilarious for those who don't stop, don't throw them out of the Seder, don't throw them out of your table. You can keep enough chairs for them. So this is the order. And my rub-up, my discovery of this meeting that takes place on Pesach that one might not have thought about is really the meeting with oneself. And I call this this part of this mystic freedom that takes place, the soulful Seder. If you would go to your source sheet number 2, we're now in source sheet number 2. I have a way of recovering and uncovering these stages of the Seder. Let's go, and you see that it starts out in the middle of the page or the upper left or on the right side. Go to your lower left side. And the lower left tells about this whole process of what happens when you think about yourself and you're concerned. The Seder is for everyone. The Seder is a communal experience. The Seder is a Jewish experience, a national experience. The Seder has universal significance. The Seder has been adopted in various religions and various cultural forms. But I would also say that the classic Jewish Seder, in its mystical understanding, is also not only familial and communal and certainly Jewish, a kind of a Jewish national experience, and also a universal experience. It's in terms of freedom, but it's also a very personal experience, and I desire to uncover that aspect with you, as it always rubs up against the other aspects, the familial, the national, the Jewish national, the universal. The very first part of the Seder happens before the Seder. You have number 1 in the red. In the red, I will always have the Hebrew term. And in the green, I will have what practically it means. And the blue, what I think is the significance. The Bedikat Chometz, the searching for the Chometz, the Biur Chometz, the destruction of the Chometz, is that which takes place in the days before the Seder. This is a time of utter confusion within a household. One cleans and cleans. One does things with the oven, which one should be doing during the whole year and does do, but one does it now with tremendous exhortation, with kosher elbow grease. It's not simple. It's not pretty. It often leads to great frustration. In many ways, it's the redoing of a slave experience. It's a very cathartic experience because you're searching, destroying the leaven. Leaven in the Talmudic and mystical tradition refers to that which rises. It refers to an element of the spirit which is very much filled with hubris, filled with kind of a personal regard that's egocentric, that may even be chutzpahdik. And the notion is, at this time of the year, we are out on a search and destroy mission to get rid of that chometz, of that leaven. We're destroying an old order, and when your house is totally up for grabs, and not just the elbow grease, but the Passover products are coming in, and the chometz products are being put aside, and for many of them to be destroyed, and for many of them to be, some of them, in case it's just going to cost you a lot of money, you can sell. Effectively, and there's confusion everywhere, you're destroying the old order. You're destroying the old order. And I think for an individual, as he confronts his soul, as he confronts what he's doing, Passover gives this tremendous opportunity, not only for a real spring cleaning, but a spring transformation, a transformation of yourself. There's a lot of Jewish tradition that allows for a strong individual experience of great fulfillment, of great uplift. There's much in Jewish tradition that allows for and creates a very independent and in some ways I wouldn't say egocentric, but an ego-positive person. But there are times on the opposite side of the fence, and the times before Passover when you are totally confused and frustrated and exhausted from the experience of making the house ready for Pesach, that's one of the times. What a great opportunity for change and for transformation. Number 2, when you go up, so I had it on the lower left because this often not a grand experience, a lofty experience of searching, destroying the leaven. It's in the trenches, and you're down and dirty, and that's where you are. You have Seder HaKa'ara, setting the Passover plate. The Passover plate, the Seder plate, is the prop upon which the entire Seder is centered. I have found that it's important to have more than one Seder plate, and generally we have at least one for every six people that are at our Seder, sometimes even more. People need to be close by the Seder plate. People need to even use the food from the Seder plate. The Seder plate should be a live participant. The Seder plate is taken from the tables at some points. It's covered at other points. It's open. One relates to it. It's all for that wonderful, magical experience of the Seder. And my suggestion is that the Seder plate should not be fully done beforehand, even though that's generally the traditional attitude. But I found as people come into the home, and there'll be several Seder plates, and maybe there will be three, four that you have one or two people who will be sitting next to that Seder plate, have them construct the Seder plate from the foods that you have ready. For the vegetarians, the beets can, with all its beet juice representing what the others have a piece of a bone or of a shank bone, but they have a beet. Let them have a beet on their plate. Let people put out the different forms of maror. Let them set it up. And in each Haggadah, there is a formulation. There's a chart in which order should it be. Let them follow whatever chart, whatever experience they want to create there. And as they're looking at it, and as they're trying to get it right on the plate, let me just tell you a hint. However they do it will be fine. It's really impossible to do it wrong. And by setting up the plate, they're setting up liberation. They're setting up a new order. They're constructing the experience. At this point, we actually go to the arena in which the Siman, which we saw on source sheet 1, of those 14 steps of the Seder, here it begins at number 3, Kadesh, sanctification of the day, which is of the evening day. That's how it works in Judaism, and how that is done. In order to do that, I need to also to look at the same time that you're looking at source sheet 2, is to look at source sheet number 1, source sheet number 3, the second, which are the sources that we are dealing with, the mystic freedom sources, source sheet number 3. And I had a number of mystical sources which inspired this whole idea of confronting oneself and for self-transformation. And the sources came from two groups of people. One is a group who were basically Ashkenazic, Lithuanian background followers of the great Rabbi Cook. And here in the Halach Ma'anya section from a book called Mei Marom, Yaakov Moshe Harlap, he was an outstanding sage of early 20th century Jerusalem. He was a mystic, and he was a legal scholar, and a close colleague of Rabbi Cook, and actually, he would say, a devoted follower. And he writes about the section, after we say Kadesh, we point to the matzah, but his point here has to do with the Kiddush, the sanctification of the wine, as well. But he talks about the matzah. The Halach Ma'anya says this is the bread of affliction, which our forefathers ate in the land of Egypt. This is the bread of affliction, he writes. This is my translation. Matzah, from one view, commemorates the Lachma Aniyah, the Aramaic for the poor bread, the bread of affliction, that the Egyptians fed Israel in Egypt so that they would not be satisfied. You never get fully satisfied eating matzah. and therefore they would be servants burdened by starvation and by the denigration of eating such poor bread. It's called lechem oni in Deuteronomy, poor bread, bread of affliction, for this reason. A second view has the reason for eating matzah, because the dough of our ancestors did not have time to leaven. Leavening is derived from a delay of time. You have enough time, the dough rises. But there was not enough time. So what does it mean to have a bread that is not subject to time? Israel rose at that point to a level above time. They ruled over time. Time did not rule over them. And from this view, matzah is the bread in which we respond. Onim, it's another further pun in many ways. Matzah is at once the bread we ate as slaves when we did not merit to rise to the level beyond time. It was very time specific. But we also say about matzah, next year we'll be free people, referring to our overcoming time. And this is what a great theme on the personal theme and the communal theme of what, and universal theme, of what the Seder is about. A point that he does not state explicitly, but is understood by anyone who studied the Talmud, that a slave is defined as a person who does not own his own time. I know many of us feel that way about ourselves. And in many ways, we do live a slave existence. But a slave does not have his own time. His master or her master is always, or the mistress, is always telling the slave what to do and when to do it. And according to Jewish law, that's the definition. Unless the act is will hurt the slave himself or herself, or unless the act is one of tremendous, tremendous denigration, the slave is bidden to do what the master or the mistress says. That's how that world works, and all of us who work for a living, we're familiar with it. So matzah is a twofold symbol. It's a symbol of that slave experience of eating slave bread, bread which is meant only for a slave who does not own her, his own time. At the same point, matzah was the food they took when they left Egypt, which they didn't have enough time for it to leaven. And symbolically, it means Jews now, having been freed, the first part of freedom, is there above time. I want to say the Seder is a type of ritual in which, some unusual ritual, in which you have a sense of timelessness. All the different, the future messianic, eschatological time, the specific time of the slave from Egypt, various historical periods, they all merge together. The only other experience I've had, both as a participant and as an officiant, of timelessness of Jewish ritual is being under the chuppah, being under the wedding canopy, in which there is a sense of timelessness. All time collapses. That's the purpose of the Seder. The Kadesh announces, just like lighting the candles earlier on, it announces the sanctification of time, transcends of time, which is best symbolized with the matzah. We're talking about personal change, personal transformation. Judaism has no problem recognizing that we have a body and soul. And it's very crucial to Judaism not to exalt one over the other, although there are times that, in the sense that, well, there are always times that one takes precedence over the other. But the extremes of what takes precedence over the other leads towards, and that's the purpose of a balance and integration. In Ur Chatz, we begin the process of reclaiming the body. That's number four. As I said earlier, you wash the hands. This is the first washing. Washing number one. You reclaim the body. You wash your hands. You feel that water over your hands is supposed to be pleasurable. It's supposed to be freeing. If we had the time, we all would dip in the mikveh, the ritual bath, but no time for that. But we would emerge with the water cleansing us, purifying us. Since the hands are the major way we encounter the world, we wash our hands. And we're beginning here to reclaim the body. The slave, bruised and battered body, the calloused hands. And all of a sudden, we're doing something very, very gentle. The hands are supposed to already be clean before they go through the orchatz. Perfectly clean. And if they're not, then you have to wash your hands with soap and water, dry them so your hands now are dry, and then pour the water over the hands. And the next step on the reclaiming of the body is karpas, number 5. The karpas, if you take the word karpas and you reverse the letters, you have samach perach, you have 60 myriads, 60,000, 600,000, referring to the mythic figure of those who were the slaves in Egypt. You have those, and what could they eat? They could only eat Jewish soul food. They ate, if at best, a little bit of a vegetable, dipped in their tears, dipped in harsh vinegar, so that they can be, it could be kept, it could be preserved, and with that karpas, and you dip it. And my hint to you is leave the karpas for several hours in the salt water. It gets a very good taste. The karpas, the vegetable, it could be celery. Some people use parsley. The Lithuanian Jewish tradition is to use a potato, a potato that's already been boiled and is soft. And to leave it there, then you pick it up. You make the blessing, and then you dip it with your fork, dip it back into the salt water. It's very tasty. And that produces, what I said, hunger. All revolution takes place when the slave gets hungry, when the slave realizes that her needs to be filled, his needs. And that's true with personal transformation. You have to have a little bit of the food. You have to have a little bit with that vinegar or salt water that produces a taste. You want to drink. You want to eat more. You want to have something. Those hors d'oeuvres set you free or set you on the path of freedom. You rediscover your body. You're allowed to be hungry. You should be hungry. It's not a denigration to be hungry. It's only a denigration is when you're not able to feed that hunger, to satisfy that hunger. And this is what the Seder is about, is making you hungry and satisfying the hunger. So we go to number 6 is yachatz, splitting the matzah or breaking the middle matzah, as I described earlier. But I believe there's something very dramatic about it. In fact, in religious observant homes, where people are always very careful to have a full matzah, just as they're careful during the rest of the year, have a full challah, when they make hamotzi, when they bless the bread on Friday night and on Saturday, and they have a full one, to break the middle matzah, and especially if you have one of those large, round hand matzahs, and they break in very unpredictable ways. All matzah breaks unpredictably. It is very dramatic because we're very careful. It's very hard to get a matzah that it's not already cracked or even broken up. And then to really crack it and to really split it is often very dramatic. I've seen young children cry because what's going on? In fact, getting them to say what's going on and getting us to say what's going on is one of the purposes of how the Seder is. And the Seder has all sorts of tricks, and this is one of the tricks. But by breaking the middle matzah, we confess to ourselves that reality is a broken reality. Reality is not the full matzah. The reality is not everything laid out 100% perfectly. You know, often all we can get is a piece of a matzah, not just a slave. Or that's part of being a slave, and we're all slaves in many ways. But the most we can get is part. And sometimes we're very happy to get a part. And sometimes all we get are crumbs. And that's a recognition that reality is not perfect. And what do we do and how do we live inside the fragments. I ask you, how do you live with inside the fragments? How do you deal with the fragments? The breaking of the matzah says many things. It says sometimes reality needs to be broken. Sometimes the elephant in the room has to be discussed. Sometimes that elephant in your brain and your emotion has to be recognized. Sometimes you have to realize that you are living in a broken reality. This is not to be in a situation in which you're constantly bemoaning your own fate, but recognizing your situation is a very dramatic moment, and hiding the piece of the matzah, which I don't have down here on that, but you split it, and hiding a piece means to say you have to still preserve that special part of you. We're going to come back to that as you deal with these fragments and the fragmentariness of life. And as you notice, Yachatz is down there on the same level as destroying the old order. Because what we've done now is we started to create a new order, but in creation of the new order, we recognize how the old order has been and how we've often lived with this broken reality. Therefore, we then go to an amazing part of the Seder, and that is the telling, Magid, the telling. And as I said, what we are involved here is in a personal journey. Let's take several crucial parts of the Magid, which is found in your Haggadah. Haggadah is the telling. Magid is how we tell it. It talks about the journey of the Jewish people historically, contemporaneously, the journey of humanity. The Jewish people are no less humans. Their story is the human story, but in a very, very etched out and very dramatic way. And it's very much a personal story. According to tradition, many of the funny things we do at the strange things we do at the Seder, that things are covered and uncovered, the strange foods, how the house is set up differently, the fact that we often recline at different elements, which is to show that we're free, things are different, is to get the young child to ask questions. According to Jewish tradition, in terms of halacha, that if a child says, "Why are we doing all this?" or says, "Everything is so different," that is exactly the four questions. In other words, you don't even have to say the four questions. Now, we say the four questions, and it's important to say the four questions. But actually, you don't need to say the four questions, because the whole idea of four questions is to get you to know something's different this night. And we say the four questions sometimes in lieu of the child saying, "How different is this night?" or the functional equivalent, but also to teach him and to teach her how to ask questions. And I say to you that it's crucial for the young child in you, the part of you that's not jaded and not over-experienced, is to lean back and recline for a moment and say, "Yes, how different is this night? How different is my life? What has my life been like? What have I undergone this year? What's happened? What's happened to me? What's happening to me? What does it mean now to be surrounded with friends? Or what does it mean right now that I'm a guest and I actually don't know anybody else at the table? What part do I bring to all this, and what part do I need to bring?" During the days before the Seder, I prepare for myself four personal questions. But the specific parts of the questions are crucial only to bring us to the notion of things are different, things can be different. How can they be different? Why do we want it to be different? That's part, and that's a crucial part of the personal journey. And then we go to the section of Avadim Hayinu, we were slaves, and at the same time we also have. Again, we're number 7, the personal journey part, the telling. We have just two beginnings to the story, telling the story. According to tradition, you're supposed to start with your lower part of you, the parts we're not so happy to talk about, and then we go to the parts that we're more proud of. And we start twice. There's a disagreement in the Gemara. How do you start the story? Some say we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and that's where it starts. And to be a slave is an act of is a terrible status to be. And others say we should start with we were really. It's a disagreement between Rav and Shmuel. And one, Rav says we were slaves, and Shmuel says we were idolaters. And we start with that. We were idolaters. It's the only time during the year that we mentioned the father of Abraham, Abraham's dad. We never mentioned him. The whole thing for Judaism starts with Abraham. But he had a dad, Terach. And Terach was an idolater. In some ways, he's our grandfather. If Abraham's our father, then he's our grandfather. But it's only when we're doing confession, when we're really trying to get at who we are, that we're able to take that out of the closet and talk about it. Therefore, if you look in the source, the third source sheets, number 3 of the third packet, and you look at number C, the Sfat Emet, and the Sfat Emet is part of the other great scholars that I followed, which was basically the Hasidic Rebbe's of Ger, the second, third, and fourth generations, in which, and this is from the second generation, the Sfat Emet, true discourse is the translation. A leader of perhaps at that point before the Shoah, the Holocaust, before the Holocaust, of the largest Hasidic group in Europe, outside of Warsaw, a book which is full of insight and a book that's full of love. And he talks about the one confessional of Avadim Hayinu. And what he says is, on that page 3, C, we were slaves to Pharaoh. And he quotes the Talmud that one begins with denigration and ends with praise. You begin with genut, denigration, and you end with shevach, praise. And he has a very powerful teaching of the founder of the Hasidic movement, the Baal Shem Tov, the Besht, the master of the great name, the good name, taught that if you want to denigrate, it's like anything else in life, denigrate yourself. And if you wish to praise, you should praise the Creator. And what does that mean? It means that anything good, and now the Sfat Emes explains the Baal Shem Tov, this means that anything good, any good attribute that one sees in oneself, you see another, he says, you know what, this comes from God. Quoting the verse, you have established the straight ones. Everything that's straight comes from him. Anything one sees, however, that is to be negated, you have to say, well, it's my problem. This is my problem. For God has made man straight, but man devises his own stratagems to make things crooked. And that was actually echoing, or Kant echoed him when Kant says, from the crooked timber of humanity, nothing straight has ever been made. And that's the problem with us. We're all somehow not, lumber. We're not completely straight. Therefore, we have to begin with how things are, with our own denigration, genut. For we were slaves in Egypt, and see how the Sfat Emet puts the two beginnings together. For we were slaves in Egypt due to our own failings. We're stemming from the fact that our forefathers were idol worshippers. Not that. It's not saying here that this was a simple punishment, that we were idolaters, and since we were idolaters, our forefathers were idolaters, we were slaves. But he really saying here is that at the very essence, we have to manufacture our own freedom, we have to find our own flaws, and we have to know how to correct them. I have seen the leaders, and sometimes I've heard the leaders of ethnic groups that have been denigrated, and they, when they speak to outside power, they say, this is what you've done to us. But when they speak to their own people, they say, It's our responsibility. We put ourselves in this own position. Two levels of discourse, two types of discourse. The discourse to the oppressor is, this is what you did to us. The discourse to those who have suffered is to say, what part have we played in our own suffering? What part, and therefore we must rectify it. When a person is in therapy, and a person goes through transformation, there's a lot of time spent, on what was done to them by, God forbid, by a parent, or by a school teacher, or someone in positions of power or authority, might even be, God forbid, a sibling. And those things must be discussed, acknowledged, and validated. But at some point, the individual has to know, what part did I play in this? What choices did I decide to make? What now must I do? This is all part of this kind of vidui, this kind of confession. And that's why it says, the more one tells the story, the more one is praiseworthy. That's a quote from the Haggadah. Not that we're praiseworthy essentially, but we become praiseworthy by telling the story. Because by telling the story, we see how we can transform ourselves. We see how we can change ourselves. And therefore, we go through this confession. And this is a hard part of the Seder, but it's a fantastically satisfying part of the Seder when we confess the lowlier parts of ourselves. And therefore, we go to the section which has endless debate in any Seder that allows for discussion. And discussion is there in any Seder worth its name, of the four children or the four sons. And the four sons are really the divided self. The Imre Emet, and that's on page 6 of your source sheets. The Imre Emet. Page six of the source sheets, the third section. And the Imre Emet says, who's the speaker of truth, the wise son, the wicked son, he says, the four sons are found in every person, especially the wise and the wicked, because the wise and the wicked are the two most intense of all sons. And his point is that we externalize the four sons, and we certainly externalize the wicked sons. But we externalize each of the four, and we say, this son is this one, this son is that one. And we do that within a family, do this within a nation, we do this within a culture, we do this between civilizations. But we all have the four sons within us. And look what he says about the four sons. Thus it is written, the wicked watches the righteous. We could say the wicked stalks the righteous, seeking to slay him, from Psalm 37. And therefore, the righteous better watch his step. But Passover is a time that one can overcome the wicked son. As we say, me, this happened to me. There are times when it is written, I'll keep a curb in my tongue, that you can't start up. And therefore, you can't start out with the externalized wicked son. And sometimes there are wicked, wicked people. But sometimes you can't even start up with yourself. Nonetheless, Passover is opposite. And you know, with the wicked son, you're supposed to rattle his teeth and say, well, I want to tell you the truth. I want to tell you that on the way you're going, you wouldn't have been one of the redeemed ones. You're not on the path towards freedom. You're not going through your soul right now. And who are you really talking? You're talking to yourself. You talk to yourself, and you say this. And you have the power of saying this because you've confessed, because you've asked the questions, because you have that hunger. Everything is building towards this point. Let me just add about two things that we continue to say in the telling. We say many other parts, and I wish I could do it all. But we sing that beautiful song, Dayenu, in which we thank God for everything he's done to us. That's a reality check. It's not all drama. It's not all storm and drang. It's not everything is thunderbolts and tears and struggling. But Dayenu kind of eases us down. Dayenu is to say, thank you, God. You did do so many things for us historically. You've done so many things for us at the time of the Exodus. You preserved the Jewish people. We live in a time of fantastic technical innovation and the ability to do some. Yes, we have all these problems, but we have the ability to do so much now. And Dayenu doesn't end with everything is perfected. The temple is still not built. We're still not in a perfected reality. But it's not just a broken reality. We have many things to be thankful for. And when it's a broken reality, there are many things to be thankful for, even within the fragments. And often at the Seder, you can look around you and see that, and you should be thankful for that parts of yourself that are strong and the parts of yourself that are true. And that's why at the end of the telling section, of telling over the story, we look at the Passover plate, we look at the Pesach, that which symbolizes the Paschal lamb, and whether it's a shank bone, or it's a chicken wing, or it's a beet, we look at the thin, fragile matzah, we look at the bitter herbs, and we see liberation ahead of us. We see the possibilities, that's why we point to the plate. And we say, why is this Pesach offering here in front of us? Well, because you passed over. The Passover offerings, because you passed over. Things could have been a heck of a lot worse. You preserved us in life. And why the matzah? Because this is actual freedom. And why the more? Because we did suffer as slaves. And therefore, once we have this telling, we start going up. We go to the rachza, the washing, the purification. And in the washing purification, here we do it with the cup, and we pour it over our hands, and we say the blessing with the water. Then we are silent after that. We go into the room. We go back from the washing. We go to eat the matzah, and we say the different blessings. And the matzah, we understand now, is liberation. And as we eat the matzah, one is supposed to recline. You have a pillow, or you have it back to your chair. Or you can lean on another participant at the Seder. You're supposed to recline, and you're supposed to do so because we're all important, and we do so because we're all achieved liberation. And from there, number 9, as soon as we've achieved liberation, we go down again to number 10. We eat the moror, the bitter herbs, because once we've achieved liberation, we need to immediately go back and really understand how difficult this whole process was. And just as we recline, as we eat the matzah, we're supposed to sit upright, not recline, when we eat the moror. And the bitter herbs, you know, there's usually two types of bitter herbs. There's the bitter herbs of the romaine lettuce, which is a dullness. It's a dull taste, slightly bitter. That is a good bitter herb because often depression, often escape from the self or the reality of who we really are, and then the lack of confirmation and validation of who we are, including lack of confirmation and validation and seeing our own difficulties and seeing our spiritual difficulties. Many times it is a kind of a dull. And there's other moror, bitter herbs, which is symbolized by the horseradish, which brings tears to your eyes, and both need to be eaten. You eat either one, you're fine. We put a little charoset on it. Charoset is this sweet paste, and each ethnic group within Judaism has a different tradition what to make it from. Apples and nuts and wine. Those from Asiatic countries have beautiful things with all sorts of spices, sweet spices, and banana. You put that on so the bitterness will not be complete. You shake most of it off because you have to feel the tears. And then we go to number, and in fact, let me tell you one more thing from our, if you go to the very last source, and the very last source of the, that we have on page 7, and number H, comes from a great Hasidic work, a radical work from the Ishpitzer, and he talks about moror. And in moror that he speaks about, the bitter herbs, He goes, Moror spices up, strengthens digestive process. Because he quotes the Talmud, bitter herbs turn over the food. This enlarging of our borders in order to receive all good things. For the Lord shall enlarge thy borders. Because a person continues to suffer, whatever he suffers is a movable peg, and we now have to replace it with something good. Basically, Moror is a purgative. Moror is to get all that dull, terrible stuff that's accumulated in your spiritual colon out of you. It's a thing to allow you to digest it all, get rid of it all, and open yourself up. There has to be the time for transformation, and the time for transformation means getting rid of the old. Yes, I know that in Korach we'll do something else, but this is a notion of it's okay to let go. Number 11, Korach, is you take the moror, and you take the matzah, you take the bitter herbs, you take the matzah, you make a sandwich out of it. Disintegration of self. As much as you let go, there's always a piece left of the old. You put together with the new freedom. You integrate that. Life is a sandwich. We put it together. We integrate the old and the new, the body and the soul. It's complete integration. And that is really, in a sense, the first course for number 12, the Shulchan Orech, the meal. The meal is just supposed to be free society. You sit like a mensch and you talk to people on both sides. You eat good food. The body is satiated. I should have put down the soul is satiated. You just feel good. And that Korach of number 11, which came from all the dramatic acts of the matzah and the moror of number 9 and number 10, it leads to Shulchan Aruch. You don't need, by the way, to have a first course, unless you're having great chicken soup. You don't really need to have with matzo balls. You really don't need to have that first course, because really the first course has been the Korach, has been the sandwich and everything else that we have eaten. At the end of the Shulchan Aruch, we come to Tzafun. Tzafun, we eat, we uncover the Afikoman. The Afikoman is that part of us that we hid away before. Up to now, we've been kind of in a binary place. We talk about the parts we want to get rid of, the parts that bother us, the parts should be disposed of as much as possible. And there's always parts that stay. And the new free person that we want to become. But the Tzafun, which is literally means uncovering of the hidden, means that part of that soul that maybe we forgot about. Some inspiration that we had, perhaps as a child, it's always good to go back to the child experiences of seeing the Grand Canyon for the first time. Of our first memories of the Seder itself and the wonderment that went with that. Perhaps the first time you were at the Western Wall, or that you were in a large group of people who came together for common purpose. Those feelings of awe, those feelings of joy, it could be brought at this time, and you bring this Tzafun, that hidden part. And this is a messianic part. Because it talks about all those things that are hidden, which can come towards future fulfillment. On the from the back to the May Marom, section B and page 2. The second, he has beautiful things to say all the way through. If you look at the second part, second paragraph, redemption means reunion of wholes that have been split asunder. You know, we did yachatz, we split things. We saw the realities broken. Of all those splits, the most dangerous split between parents and children. And this is a central point in terms of what exile is. Quoting the Talmud, oi to the children been exiled from the table of their parents. In contrast, the joy of redemption is return of the hearts of the parents to the children and the hearts of the children to their parents. It's a resolution time. It's the complete of all integration time. And the tzafun should be a generous moment. And that generous moment then is fully expressed in 14. Barech, you say grace. In grace, you thank God. But you bless everyone at the table. That's a central part, one of the central parts in the grace of the Seder meal. If it's your Seder, you thank God for all the people who are present and around you, if you're making that Seder. If you're a participant, you thank the people who have hosted, and you bless those people who are around you, those people who have made the Seder. One of the great things about a Seder, when the Seder works right, is that if you're not with family, the people around you become family. Because the story, your own individual process, they have their own individual process. And there's a process you go through together. You are linked together. The Seder does this to you. And therefore, what's left now is to bless the people around you. And that's part of this harachamon, we say. May the merciful one extend his blessings upon all those who are here at this Seder. And this Seder is the microcosm for the entire larger family, the Jewish family, and in many senses, the family of man, although we concentrate on the Jewish family at the Seder. It's a covenantal experience. And that is the essential nature of our own transformation. No longer complaining, no longer finding fault, no longer finding fault with others and with ourselves. We bless, we are thankful for what we have. And therefore it leads to number 15, Hallel, those selected parts of the Psalms, which is complete praise to God. It's joyful, it's melodious, the best way we can do it. But by this point, we're on the third cup of wine. We feel good. It is melodious. And just as we've had integration of body and soul through the eating of the meal, and through the Shulchan Orech, number 12, and through eating the hidden part in 13, now we have complete integration with God. This is called in Kabbalistic term Devekut, cleaving to God as God cleaves to us. Number 16 is Nirtzah. We end, we accept what God has done for us, but we accept for what we've done. Nirtzah is very simple. It says the Seder is finished. We've done our best, and you know what? All we asked for, and we've done it. We've finished it. We've accomplished it. We're not supposed to doubt ourselves. All we asked for is to be able to do it again, another time. As people leave, and those who run the Seder do the dishes, and if you're good guests, you help them, it's a tradition to sing the Song of Songs. Song of Songs, and if you can't sing the whole thing, just leave. Leave it out. It's at the back of many of the Haggadahs. Take a verse, look at a verse, sing the verse out loud. There are many songs based on the verses of Song of Songs. Do the dishes. The whole order has been complete. We started by making the dishes kosher, getting rid of the chametz, and now we're at the end. And we sing of the full integration, body, soul, ourselves with our friends, with our family, in the larger complexes that make our identity, with God, song of love, songs of love, the song of love. And that's what the Seder process in the end is about. Wish you all a happy and kosher Passover.
Thank you, Rabbi Landes. Thank you for joining us on the first episode of our new series, Unexpected Encounters, the Jewish Holidays and the Other, sponsored by the Alexander Soros Foundation. We look forward to the next episode in this new series, which will be on Yom HaTzmaut. We are planning another podcast about Pesach, so be sure to tune back in a couple of days to download that one. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.